Hello, dear heart. Welcome to the Flourishing Practitioners podcast, where we talk all things about space holding, caring for our clients, and succeeding in our businesses. We explore the wisdom from coaches, counselors, and healers. My name's Gabrielle Walker, and I'm so honored that you're here. Let's dive in. I really hope you enjoy this podcast with Aaron Taylor as a tailor. And I appreciate so deeply his generosity in sharing his story with us all. For me, it's a really special story in that he's able to articulate it. He's done the work to be able to do that. Regardless of what we navigate and overcome in life, it can be really challenging to do that. Having said that, this is a podcast that has a lot of topics: drug abuse, abuse, and being involved in that world. And also overcoming that world and the supports required to exit it. So I just want you to know that if you are someone who isn't able to listen to those sorts of things, this is your time to transition to another one. Ezra also extends his invitation to you all for an event that he has next weekend, 10th of August 2024. So if you want to check that out, that's on the show notes on my website. We have a kōpuhuri, a wormwork wānanga coming up on the 17th and 18th of August. If you're still interested, there's a few places. And we will be running a kōtora whānui miri miri training in Raglan on the 21st and 22nd of September this year. In November, we have both the miri miri and rumi rumi wānanga happening as well, if you feel the call to that. So without further ado. Hi everyone, so today I'm here with Ezra, or Aaron Taylor, and he's a colleague of mine, and a Wadjuk Baladong Noongar man through the Collard, Benau and Shaw families, and he dropped out of school at 13, and Ezra is now a psychology student. He's nearly finished his undergrad, he's going to enter masters, hopefully. He was awarded the Vice Chancellor Award at Monash University, and he is also the First Nations Lead Facilitator through Kulbadi Aboriginal Centre, and tutors in the Wanju Budja unit. And he's a family man. He's got 9 children and 13 grandchildren, a man of God, and plays with unique revival fire, and has so much more strings to his bow, which I'm sure we'll hear about today. So welcome, Ezra.
Thank you. It's very happy to be here and have this chat with you, Gabrielle.
What made me curious about talking to you was your story and what you've been through, but also how that can support and help others. And for you, you can share your story however you want, but what sits with you at this point of time about your journey to this moment?
I look back, I've actually got a testimony night coming up soon. And so I've actually been like retracing my whole journey. Looking back, I'm just really amazed how far I have come. It's, you know, when you consider in 2018, I was sitting in Haikia prison. 2019 started at Murdoch University, and retracing over those footsteps, I was just like, wow, look how far things have turned around and how quickly that it's happened. Not that I'm worried about the journey. I'm not worried. Not that I'm worried about the outcome at the end of it, because I'm having such a good time on this journey. So, yeah, at the end of the year, I'll hopefully graduate my undergrad in psychology and hopefully get accepted into master's. Honours first and then masters. Yeah, just sometimes I have to pinch myself and go, wow, this is insane. And another little thing that's happening on the side of that that's been really cool is because I've got a testimony night coming up in Rockingham, a lot of people from my past are seeing the posts about it on Facebook and on Instagram and stuff, and a lot of them are reaching out to me at this point of time. So, like, it's been like, yeah, I'm kind of on a bit of a cloud at the moment. I've been, like, feeling really good about where I am. And I'm not only getting people reach out to me that are struggling, I'm getting a few of those, but I'm also getting people reach out. I'll give you an instance. One friend from my past reached out and said, you know what, Ezra, I saw you leave this drug game that you were in, and she goes, and you inspired me, and a year later I left, and I'm now studying like you are, and I'm going to complete my degree very shortly as well. And she was like, so I just want to thank you for inspiring me. And to get messages like that, they touch my heart, and it's really, really cool. So yeah, I'm kind of looking at all this and just going, wow, man, it's an amazing journey I'm on, and I really hope that it does encourage someone else in that space to come and join me. I need people struggling from their past to be able to see themselves in me. They need to look at me and go, wow, this guy, I remember this guy. He was an addict. He was a drug dealer. He was in jail, just like I am. Man, I wonder if I can go and do what he's done. And the answer to that is, yeah, you can. Yeah, you can. So that's really important.
Thank you. What do you think there was anything in your childhood that could have changed to not get you to prison? Or it can be anything.
If I look back on my childhood, the thing that led me on this crazy path was leaving school. Like that 100% was the worst decision I ever made. And when I trace all my bad history back through court and through all that, I trace it back to that moment of leaving school. Once I left school, had no structure in my life. It's hard to explain. It was a missing piece that I always struggled with. I always regretted it. And there were times when I'd be going to court, and I used to sit on the train on the way to court. I had to go to court every Friday, and I'd be sitting on the train and I'd have tears in my eyes because I would look at the people on the train all in their suits and ties, and they're all going off to these wonderful big buildings in Perth to be productive members in community. And there's me sitting on the train, haven't had a shower for 3 days, on drugs, just going to court. And I used to look at them in awe, and I would be like, I want to be one of you. How do I get there? And for me, education was the key to get there. And so my regret to leave school carried on through my whole life. And when I think about the one thing that's changed my life back in the right direction, it's going back to school. I mean, it's university now, but going back to school has been like a massive part of my journey. I wouldn't be here without university, without Kulbati Aboriginal Centre. It's been so important in my rehabilitation to have a community that I've been able to connect to here, and people around me that are really supporting me. Yeah, it's just really, really important to be here.
I guess what I'm curious about is how culture plays into the path that you took, or if it didn't, if it was a component of going down that path of, you said you were dealing drugs, you ended up in prison. Does it sit there or does it not?
So for me, connecting back to my culture has been front and center of my rehabilitation process. It's something that the psychologist can't give me. It's something that the counselors couldn't give me. And it's something that drug court couldn't give me. And actually, culture's kind of missing from a lot of the programs that I came through to get here. It was missing altogether. So when I stepped on the doorstep of Kulbati Centre and found these amazing Aboriginal people, some really connected strongly to their culture. That was really important for me because I hadn't been connected to my culture since I was 14 years old. The drug world has its own culture. It has a culture built on muscle and violence and prison time, and it's got its own currency. It's like its own little nation, and it's hard to see anything outside of that. I remember when I was stuck in the drug world. I even remember when I used to walk around my town. There's obviously a lot going on outside of the drug world, but I can't see it. I can't see it at all. One of the funny things that happened when I came out of my addiction was even going down to the Kwinana Adventure Park. This adventure park has won national awards for being the best adventure park in Australia, and I'd never been there, never seen it with my kids. And I remember when I was straight going down there and just seeing all this wonderful life happening down there, and it was like, oh, it was insane. So the drug world keeps you from all that. So when I rocked up at Kulbati Centre, and I hadn't really connected to culture since I was 14. So that's like almost, 35 odd years or something, 30 odd years of being disconnected from culture. And the only Aboriginal people I would see would either be the ones that are in jail, the ones that are coming around to buy drugs. There's some of the see I would see in this world that I was in, and I'm supporting that. I'm dealing drugs to these guys, so I'm the part of the big problem. So it was really important for me to come to a place like Kulbati and see amazing Aboriginal people who are strong in culture, who are doing amazing things, because I need to see myself in them as well. Like, I need to see successful, strong Aboriginal people at university so I could look at them and go, yeah, I want to be like that. Yeah, just it was really, really important.
So I'm wondering, because a lot of people who listen to this are practitioners, so they could be counselors or psychologists. If we are working with different cultures, particularly Aboriginal cultures, and what do you think we're missing at points, or in that understanding of how important, is there anything we could know as non-Aboriginal people and our.
This is a really, really big question at the end of the day. It's a massive question. The first thing any therapist or anyone working in the space can do is educate themselves in the space. Don't rely on Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people to educate you in the space. You can start your own education right now by like even simply going onto Google or looking at the research says, what are some of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander research say in your space that works? We've got amazing people. We've got one here, Dr. Bep Ewing, who's doing amazing, racism research and stuff. We've got people like Tracy Westerman, who's out there just changing the face of psychology for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, not only practitioners, but also traveling around the country and running her cultural awareness programs throughout the country. Get along to those programs and educate yourself. When I came through my rehabilitation, I had two counselors. I had two separate psychologists. I had one that I was paying myself, and then I had one that the drug court had given me while I was in detox. I had a CAPS officer. Obviously, had a whole court process going on because I'm on drug court. It's a therapeutic court, so that was full of all people as well, and they were all white, and very little cultural sensitivity or cultural comfort was given in those places. It's just missing, and so. When I would look at the drug court program, and I would find that there's only myself, and I only ever saw a couple of other Aboriginal peoples involved in the program. Is that why? Is that why? Because is there a gap? Is there a gap there that's not being filled by either an Aboriginal practitioner or fill it with someone who can provide that cultural sensitivity and cultural safety to our people to get them on a program that works for 75% of the people that go in it? I don't know no other rehab center. Maybe there is, but I don't know any other rehabilitation center that has those type of numbers. 74% success rate is a massive number to me. So, can we make it more culturally safe and sensitive for our people to get on programs like that? If we're the ones that are filling the jails, why don't some of these programs cater more for our people?
You said that you felt like you lost contact with culture at 14, 13, 14 in a way. And then, but this the cultural security is still safety and nourishment is still required. Do you have an idea of how to explain that to people who might not grasp it, that in their heads they might be like, well, you left culture.
I'll explain it like this. We all, as human beings, have an innate need to bond to people. When you're broken, like I was, you will bond to whatever dysfunction you can, whatever that might be. And that's where you kind of find your family. And sadly, I fell into the drug world, and the drug world's got its own culture. And when I was in it, I loved that culture. I was connected to it. They were my people. You just become a part of it, and they are your people. It's not until that dysfunction really started becoming hurtful to myself. At the end of that, I was clinically depressed. I was with depression and anxiety. I would have suicidal thoughts all the time. I really needed help. And I went through the process of getting counseling. I went through the process of, talking to psychologists. I dealt with all my family, all the trauma that I had from when I was young. I am a person that's been through abuse. I had to deal with all that. But when I stepped out of that, I was alone again. And I was alone because if I go and connect back to the culture that I know, it means it's going to be destructive for my life because the only culture that I know is that drug culture, that drug world, and they were my people. So I had to disconnect from all that. Disassociation is key to coming out of addiction. After I deleted all those people from my phone, I had two people left in my phone, and that was my sister. And my current partner, Chevy, was the only person from my past who she actually came out and got clean before I did. And she'd reconnected with me while I was in rehab. She heard I was in there trying to change my life. And so I've only got two people left on my friends list, let's call it. Even my Facebook, I had to delete all my Facebook accounts, all my social media accounts, and I had to start again. Start again with two friends. So if I don't find my community soon, there's going to be trouble. I'm going to fall back into my old life and I'm going to struggle with that. So, my first community I found, I'll step through a couple of the communities I found. My first community I found when I first stepped out of rehab was MANA. That was a program that I went to for 3 years. The MANA community, these are all Māori men or strong Māori men. And I went and I sat in their program and I actually connected to the Māori culture before I connected to my own. And while I was in there, I spent wonderful time and these men that I was sitting with, we cried together a lot, but we taught each other a lot. And more than anything, I really learned a lot from them. I learned a lot about how to be a good father, how to reshape my home so that my home, is functional again. They introduced me to Jesus Christ, who I still follow to this day. And it was a really, really good program. But while I was in that program, I used to think, but where are my people? Where's my culture? Where are my strong Aboriginal family people that I can go and connect to? And they were missing from my life until I stepped on the Kulbadi Centre. And I guess to answer your question, my Aboriginal culture wasn't important to me during that time, that big gap, because I wasn't looking for it. I already had a culture. I already had this wonderful, what I thought was this wonderful community of people around me who loved me and, would die for me. So I thought that's all a lie. They love you and do what they do for you because of the drugs, but at the time you don't know that. I know that now. But yeah, I wasn't looking for another culture. I had my people. I found my people. But when I came out, I was totally alone. I can't explain to you how alone I was. I was so alone. And I realized, and I kind of say this statement, I realized that when I was with those people in my past, I was alone then too. I was surrounded by people, but felt so alone. So alone. Especially towards the end. And that's where all that clinical depression and anxiety and the thoughts of suicide that I used to have. I remember sitting in my CATS office, which is the Court Assessment Treatment Service, one day, and I was so broken that day. I had a house full of people back at home, and I had to go up for my weekly urinalysis. And I remember just sitting in there, and I was thinking, "Man, I'd rather jump in front of this train back to Kwinana than jump on it. I don't even want to go back to my own house because it's full of these people that I'm surrounded by that are just." They're at the core of this problem as well that I'm in, and that's how bad it got. And so, getting rid of all those, which is rehabilitation 101, getting rid of all that, and then having to find a community was so important. And it was Kulbadi Centre where I found my community, and I'm so grateful that I found my culture here too. I tell everyone this. I say connecting to my culture was front and center of my rehabilitation process. Kulbadi gave me so much more than that, but that's a big thing that it gave me was culture, connecting to my culture. And so it's an interesting question you asked because it wasn't important to me because I wasn't looking for it. And I thought that I had my culture and I thought that I was surrounded by people that loved me, but as it turned out, I wasn't.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that response. And yeah, well, I want to give a shout out to Kulbadi too, because I feel like it's taken me and little Māori girl and Noongar Pota. And I also really relate to that with a lot of people who come through like Ako Toro Whānau, the training I do with that disconnection from home and culture and the Māori sense as well. So
Yeah.
I think it's so valuable to different people. One thing that was sort of pinging me, I don't know, it's like I'm always curious when I'm working with people about what it is that really motivates you to change. Like is it an internal knowing, or because sometimes you'll work with people and you're like they're not really in it. Does that make sense?
Yep.
That yeah, I don't know. Can you describe that thing or feeling?
What made me change out of my past?
Yeah, what was that thing?
Okay, towards the end, my drug dealing had gotten right out of control. I used to really spin out when people would come to me and tell me, "As you're the biggest dealer around here now." And I would be going, "No, I'm not. No, I'm not." But before I knew it, I was just dealing copious amounts of methamphetamines to massive amounts of people. Had major crime running through my house, had the drug squad running through my house constantly. I was in a really, really bad relationship at the time, and my circle was starting to become really dysfunctional and disorganized. These people that I thought were my friends and thought loved me and all of this, it just became really dysfunctional. And I was going down and down and down. And I remember sitting in a doctor's office one day, and I was actually there for someone else. And he was like, "Can I see you for a minute?" And he took me in. And I must have just had that discernment of me that I just looked so ill. And he just took me in and just did checkups on me. And he did blood tests and all that. And then he ran these psychological tests on me. which I know what they are now. I study psychology, and I failed them all miserably. And he said, "Bro, you need help." He said, "I can see you're sick." And he said, "I can see you're ill." I told him all about my meth smoking. I smoke meth every day for the last 10 years or something, like nonstop. And I told him about my lifestyle. And he was just like, "This is going to kill you. This is going to kill you." And he gave me this form to go and get psychology, like 10 psychology sessions that the government supplies you with. And I took that form home. I never did nothing with it for a while, but then things just really, really crashed. And I was at total rock bottom. And then I was like, "Man, I'm going to go and see this lady and just see, I'll see this psychologist and just see what happens." So I guess the thing that started me on this path was hitting rock bottom. Fortunately, not long after that, I think I was seeing this psychologist. I think I had a session once a month, and I think I was only about three sessions in. Bang, major crime hit my house again. And I got caught this time, and I got thrown in Hakea prison. And this time I was definitely looking at a custodial sentence. Got caught with way too many drugs to even think of getting off this time. And I'm in Hakea prison, and I heard about drug court in there. I tried to get hold of the duty lawyer person, couldn't get hold of them. And so just when I was up in front of the judge, I just said, "Judge, can you please put me on this program?" I said, "I've never ever had support trying to deal with this problem." I said, I'm an addict. I'm 100% an addict." I remember telling him, "I don't go around. I've got no violence on my records. I'm not going around booting people's door downs. I'm not going around stealing stuff." He said, "I'm not a thief. I've never liked stealing. I'm not that type of person." I said, "But I deal a copious amount of drugs because I've got a really, really bad drug problem." And the judge said, "All right, I'll give you a go on this program and we'll see what we can do." And then not long after that, I got remanded. Now, had that not happened, I don't think I'd be sitting here right in front of you now, because I'd made the decision to change. I'd made that first little step to see this psychologist. I was 3 months in, but I'd still haven't spent one day off smoking drugs. But I'm there really trying to get my mental health better. But I'm sitting in the office. You know, I'd have my bag there with like ounces of meth in my bag while I'm doing my interview. So, but I'd made that first step. And so when you ask what made you change, I think it was really, really hitting what I call rock bottom. There were several times when I thought I was at rock bottom, but when I actually hit rock bottom and reached out to that psychologist to get help, that was off my own back. It ended up that I had to pay for those. So I was using my drug money, I was dealing drugs, and then I would use that same money to pay to try and fix me, which that is quite crazy. So I was paying for my psychology lessons with my drug money. But the cool thing that happened is when I went on drug court, and you've got to get accepted on the program, not everyone gets accepted and they've got really limited spaces. The cool thing that happened with me is because I started that psychology thing on my own, I started seeing a psychologist. The judge said, "You've already invested in your own rehabilitation on your own." And she said, "No, that's really positive for me. So I'm going to put you on this program." I was lucky to get on there because I'd actually been caught with more drugs than what you're allowed to get on drug court with. I was over this limit that they had. If you get caught over this limit, you're not allowed to go to drug court. You have to just go to normal court. And the judge actually swung things around, which allowed me to stay on the program. So I was really quite lucky. A couple of worlds collided there just to make that really good. But the thing that happened to me personally is that I was at rock bottom at that moment. I was at rock bottom. I was facing lengthy jail term. I was suicidal. I'd been clinically diagnosed with depression, anxiety, and my whole world around me was falling apart. My kids didn't even want to know me. They weren't even coming to see me anymore. And I was living this lifestyle of just running drugs. And it's so busy and it wears you so thin when you're responsible for thousands and thousands of dollars that you carry around in your back. You can get robbed anytime. You can get beat up and smashed. People take your stuff. You're trying to control this whole big, this business, we'll call it. And yeah, and it just wore me and wore me and wore me until I hit rock bottom. So I think for a lot of people reach out when they're really, really at rock bottom. And I think that's a time when like change can be made.
Thank you. Often there's these stories told about like, oh, if you just get help, or if you know, once you get to uni, it'll be fine. From what I'm hearing from you, there was an ecosystem of things that were taking place to allow you really to give you the best chance. And lots of it was chance, is also what I'm hearing. You were ready to take the opportunities, but it was also a bit of chance. Is there any of the other programs you wanted to speak to at all?
This is the other thing. When I first came out, I realized something, and that was that going to see a psychologist once a month for 1 hour is not going to help me. I had to get busy with investing into my own mental health and back into my life. So some of the programs I did positive lifestyle program with Salvation Army. I did that in the first year that I came out of rehab. I went to a detox center to detox. That was the SWU, the Serenity Withdrawal Unit, down at Serenian House in Rockingham. I spent the first 14 days clean off meth in about 10 years in that center. It was the first time I'd ever had that long off meth. I started to think straight when I was in that center. My mind started changing. My thoughts started moving from this drug world to this world of like, man, you've got to go and reconnect with your kids. You've got all this stuff that you've got to do. You've got to stay on this path. The Man Up program was front and center of my rehabilitation. Without them, I wouldn't be sitting here today. If anyone's listening to this with someone struggling, I would implore you reach out to this program just to learn how to be a man again, learn how to connect to people again, learn how to love again. I speak about this. I'm going to speak about this on my testimony night, and I might just mention a bit here. Often we speak, when we speak about love, we usually speak about from the perspective of giving love to someone. But when you come from this broken perspective of what you believe that love was, like coming out of a drug world, believing all these people love me and these are my family, and these are who would just disappear the minute there was trouble or the minute the drugs were gone, they were gone. And you have this broken perspective of what you think love is. Being a part of Man Up really learned me how to love again. It learned me how to accept people back, love, learned me how to, taught me how to forgive myself. That was huge. How to get rid of the shame. I still live in the same town I dealt drugs in for 20 years. So there's a lot of shame attached to that. I've got to walk past the broken houses in my town that I had a part in breaking. I still deal with that a bit today, but Man Up really helped me overcome that sort of shame and guilt. The biggest thing Man Up did for me, but was introduce me to Jesus Christ. And this is something that I tell all my friends that are stuck in their path when they say, like, how did you come out of this 20-year meth addiction and end up at a university? And I tell them, I say, it's because I believe in Jesus. My whole journey started with Jesus, and now it'll end with Jesus because I'll be with him forever. And having someone spiritually connect that I could connect to spiritually, you know, like I pray with my family every morning. I have a certain tree down Callista Oval that we used to do Man Up at. We used to do Man Up under this tree as a group. We'd all sit there and talk about our problems and stuff like that. And I wasn't really connected to Jesus yet, right? I was kind of in that space of like, this Jesus thing, man. Like, who's this Jesus character? And I would learn bits about him throughout the program. The program doesn't shove him down your throat. They've got this wonderful program that Jesus is connected to. And throughout the program, I just would hear more and more, and I'd be like, all right. And so what I started doing is I started returning to this tree. When the Man Up sessions weren't there, we're there every Saturday, but during the week, I would take my dog for a walk. I would stop at this tree and I just learned to start praying at this tree. And everything I have now, like a house and my kids back, my family connected, I used to ask for an education. I didn't know how he was going to do that, right? I used to sit under this tree and I used to pray on my own under this tree. And I used to ask for an education. It's linked to me sitting on that train at those times crying on the way to court. And I'll be so upset that I left school and I'll be like, you know, like, God, give me an education. I don't know how you're going to do it, but I want an education. And I tell you now, everything I asked for at that tree when I was praying, I have in my life. Every single thing. I lost two houses. Listen, I bought two houses when I was in that world, mostly off drug money and stuff. I lost both of those in that world as well. And so I used to pray to God to give me a house, you know, like, and my dad just gave me a house. My dad looked after a guy for years and years, got given a house when he passed away. This guy left him a house. So my dad's got two houses, two kids, and he's just gone here. Bang, you guys have these houses. So, you know, when I came out of my addiction, didn't even have a roof over my head. I prayed for a house. My dad just gave me one. Things like that. And it's not to say that the things with counseling didn't help as well, but it all started with meeting Jesus and Man Up at that tree. And I owe that program so much. I facilitated that program for a couple of years after I was in it just to make sure that I gave back. But I love that program. And I've seen so many broken people come to that program who are now living like, you know, wonderful lives connected back with their family and stuff. That was one of the big ones. My counselors and my psychologist really helped. The other two big things that helped me was drug court. If you're struggling, if you're or someone in your family struggling in addiction and they're in the justice system, drug court is the way out. A real holistic care package put around you. It's not just counseling once a week. One thing drug court gave me was structure. Well, I had no structure in my life. I had man up on Saturdays and I had counseling once a week and my psychologist once a month, but I really had no structure. Drug court, 3 urinalyses a week, smart groups, one night a week as well. Got to meet with your counselor, got to meet with your CATS officer once a week, court every Friday. So all of a sudden, I'm dealing out of my house. Now I've got responsibilities. Oh man. I think it was Friday mornings. I used to have to go to court. I have to get up real early, 8:30 in the morning, rather than go out and deal drugs. Now I've got to get on the train, go to Perth, go to court. I'm in court all day. After court, I've got to go see my CATS officer, interview. Mondays, I have urinalysis at the hospital, and then I've got my counselling session. I just started getting really busy in my own life. Funnily enough, when I got to Kulbardie, I still had all these responsibilities to take care of. I nearly went back to jail just because I was so busy studying. I forgot about my drug court responsibilities. Had to have a meeting with the staff here. And so they used to come looking for me on Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays. And if I was still studying around lunchtime, they used to boot me out on the bus to go down and do my urinalysis. If you get to 10 points, you go to jail for 2 weeks as a fine type thing. And I was sitting on 8 points. And like, so once more, I was going to go. So yeah, they're the main programs. And probably the last people I'll reach out to, your local church. Local churches are a wonderful place. I'll tell you something. When I came out of my addiction, my house was trashed. It was a mess. It was full of all busted stuff that I'd bought off people that I had no use, and my houses were trashed. It wasn't my counselors, it wasn't my psychologist, it wasn't drug court that came and helped me clean it up. It was people from my church. When I was struggling, 3 a.m. in the morning with something, or something went bang, it wasn't my counselors or psychologists. It was my local church that came and stepped up. Reach out to your local church. A lot of them have a lot of wonderful programs, a lot of things going on. I'm fortunate enough to be connected to a small ministry called Unique Creative in Rockingham. And it's through there. Play every Sunday we meet, we play our worship music, get ready. Once a month, we do a testimony night. It's my testimony night coming up August 10th. So if you can get along at the Salvation Army calling out. We also go out to towns. We just got back from doing a weekend in Northam where we just go up and just spread the word of Jesus around, around the community up in Northam. I've been real fortunate enough to run into that community and I have really great spiritual leaders there, Mama T, Dave, who they're at my beck and call 24 hours a day. And it's those type of people that you won't find in the system, in the system to help you, but they are there. And they can probably provide a lot, I don't know, a lot of that comfort that you need when you come out of addiction. They can fill that space, that loneliness space. You need to find a community. There's a community at every church on just about every corner in the country. Go find your community in church. There's some wonderful people there.
I guess I'm curious about potentially what you see the difference for support for men or males compared to women. And often the systematic people are often women as well, psychologists, counselors, whatever. So is there anything, that comes to mind with that thought?
From a support perspective, every support person from the minute I got out of jail, even to just about this day, has been a woman. Other than my man up group, which is one that I went out and got, all the professional support was all women all the way through. And even when I got to Kulbardie, I remember getting to Kulbardie and it was just full of all these amazing women as well, like all working here. I'm trying to think if there was one man working here at the time. I don't think there was when I first came here. I'm thinking hard. I don't think there was. And I was just like, man, I'd come out of. Listen, I walked into here pretty naive, right? I've been stuck in this drug world and not seen all the amazing things that women are doing out there. But when I just kept running into all these amazing women, I was just like, women are killing it. And I've been oblivious to that for years because I hadn't been out seeking it. Like in the drug world, it's pretty much run by men. And women were really killing it. And it was quite an amazing space. But it does beg the question, where are all the men in this space? Like I said, I was fortunate enough to run into Man Up where I met amazing men. Big shout out to Terry Campbell, who is still the director of Man Up. If you want to get there, you can look up Terry on Facebook. Their program, without that and meeting them strong men, I don't say I wouldn't be here. I don't know, but it was really, really important. And they were the first program that I actually went and sat in, and I'm so glad that I did. Man Up were also the first people. One day I was at a Man Up session, and I said. I stood up at the end and I said, look, guys, I just want to say I've got court tomorrow. So if I'm not here next week, it's because I've been locked up. And it's not because I don't want to be here. I've loved the program. I was kind of having that speech. And one of the leaders, Adam Gates, he stood up and he said, what time's your court, bro? And I was like, oh, no, I wasn't saying for that. I was just saying because I love the program. I don't want you to think that I just left. And he goes, no, when's court? I'll come. And I was really shocked by that. And I said, oh, it's like I've got to be there like 9 a.m. in the morning. He said, oh, I'll come to court. And I was so shocked. And then, like, when I caught the train up, him and his wife were waiting outside the magistrate's court for me in Perth and couldn't believe it. And I was like, wow. And I went and sat down and I had a tear in my own court. I was like, man, this is the first time someone's come to court and supported me. And it was someone from my men's group that I was going to see. So having a relationship with men during that phase, really, really important. But to be truthful, it was missing from the, all the professional stuff and that I was connected to. And here's the other thing. Even when I sat in court, my judge was a woman, the prosecutor was a woman, my lawyer was a woman, and all the CAPS officers were women. So even when I sat in court, one day I was in court. I'll tell you what, one day I was in court and I said to the judge, and I'd met all the amazing women at Coolvardie Centre. And I remember this has just popped into my head, so I'm going to say it. I remember being in there and saying this to the judge. I was like, man, I can't believe that all you, it's all women, all like seem to be running all these, almost running society now. And I told the judge, and I said, it's International Women's Day today, judge. So I want to give you a round of applause. And the whole court just clapped for International Women's Day because every single person involved in my rehabilitation was a woman. And it was a moment that just popped back in my head. I remember that. That was just a moment. And I remember the judge saying, oh, that's definitely worth a round of applause, and gave a round of applause. But yeah, even my court was full of all women. So yeah, men are missing from the space, that's true. But women are holding it up. So it's not to say that it's bad, but women are doing exactly what they need to do. But yeah, we'd love to see some more men in this space.
I really agree. I think there's some things that need to come from men to men,
Yeah.
and even as awesome a job as we're doing. So once you sort of pass the rock bottom stage in life, you could see some changes in life. What do you think were some challenges or different pitfalls that came up after that? Or were you just gung ho on that path?
I was definitely gung-ho once I got structure back into my life, and definitely once I started at university, I definitely was gung-ho. And now I was busy every day of the week, and it was just head down, tail up from that minute on. Some of the big obstacles were in the first year that I got clean, I lost eight people from my past, and one of them was my brother. So to go through such a horrible first year was like, it was insane. And even when I was at Coolvardie Centre, losing my brother was really hard. Now, if I'm going to relapse, it's going to be now. Drug court got really behind me. The people, Man Up, and the ladies' side of that is called Sisterhood Empowerment. They all came to my house. They cooked my family dinner all day. It was this. This is why these programs are important. It wasn't my psychologist that came around my house. It wasn't my, counselors that came to my house. It wasn't my CATS officers. They do a wonderful job, but it's people from these church programs. They converged on my house. They stayed all day. They cooked my family's dinners all day. The men made sure that I was taken care of, and they sat with me for hours and days on end. It was these people that came around and really, really supported me. So there was a heap of challenges. And losing so many people in that 1 year, I don't know if it was like, I don't know if we were, that's how many people were dying regularly. And I just wasn't noticing because I was so cooked and off my head. But to me, that was a lot. And that too kept me on my path. When I was out of the world and I can look back and see the devastation in it, man, I never wanted to go back there again. So I had to be real headstrong about it. And I had to make decisions that supported that. Like when my brother died, I could have took the whole month off uni, which most of my family did. We don't like to really go back to work in that, well, until we put our family members in the ground. But I had to. So I was the one family member that only took a few days off K-Track, and then I had to come back. If I stayed at home and I mourned at home and I had to go through this terrible time at home, probably would have relapsed. And those decisions helped me. When I went back to drug court, I remember the judges commended me, going, look, if you were going to relapse, it was going to be this week. And they said, we had big fears of what was going to happen with you because you've been doing so well. But they were so proud of me that I just put these things in place that got me through that. So yeah, there's definitely been challenges. There's been challenges in our family with relapse, and then there've been other challenges. Just recently, 6 weeks ago, my brother's son lost to addiction. So we're still and me and him, we used to deal together. Like we were in that world together, and we used to deal together. And since I came out clean and he's still in there, I had to disassociate from him. So we didn't really have a relationship, and now he's gone. So you got to live with these little things of like, man, I couldn't have a relationship with him. I wish I could have. And now he's gone. I wonder if I did have a relationship with him. I wonder if I could have helped him. I don't know. So now my oldest brother and his oldest son are both gone to addiction. So yeah, it's really, really important. So there's always going to be challenges. There's always going to be hurdles. What I've found is every time they've popped up, because I'm not connected to my counselors and that anymore, it's been my church family and my Kulbadi family that have filled that void and helped support me through that space. So you really need to have challenges are going to come up regardless. I remember one challenge. Here's one challenge that I had when I first came out of rehab is I came out of Serenity Withdrawal Unit and I'm not even going to say how much money I owed. I owed heaps and heaps of money. And I'm like, now I'm clean. I'm going to go get my money. And me, stupid, thinking, yeah, that's how that was going to go, you know? And the very first house I went to get my money, they didn't have any money, but they had drugs. And they said, well, here. And they gave me drugs. And I've just come out of rehab, right? And I'm like, all right, I'm strong. I'm just going to go sell these drugs, get some money, you know? I took those drugs, went to a couple of houses, and then just ended up back at my house with this big bag. And so, what did you think is going to happen? Relapse straight away. So, I've just gone and I've just spent my first 14 days clean and I've relapsed straight away. And I rang my daughter and I told her what happened. I said, look, I've just gone to rehab. You know, I've been clean 14 days. I've come home and I've relapsed again straight away. And she just said, lock your house up and come and stay with me. So, I rang a friend who came, knocked on my door, and I just handed them the drugs out the door. And I just said, you don't have to pay me for that. That's yours. See you later. And I locked my house up and left. That was when I knew I was giving up for good, because now I'd just given away, like, you know, quite a big bag of drugs and just given it to someone else and walk. But I had to come to the realization of something. Number one, I've got to forget about all the money that I'm owed. I can't go collect it. It's going to be bad for my health. It's going to be, that was one of the first decisions that I had to make that day. Even now, I'll run into people from my past that owe me thousands and thousands of dollars, man. And I say, hey, how you going? Shake your hand. I'm home. I pray that you'll get out of this. I'm hoping that you'll get out. I never mention the money again. It's gone. It's not a part of my life. I have way more worthy things in my life now than worrying about money that I made from my past. Making that decision was really big. That's one of the big decisions every addict's got to make coming out. If you're a drug dealer and you come out, if you want to go and collect your money, it's going to cost you. It really is. It's going to cost you. On the flip side of that, after I spent some time at my daughter's, I spent, I think it was about 9 months or something, close to a year living at my daughter's. So I did rehab through Dawn, which is the Drug and Alcohol Withdrawal Network, but I rehabbed at home and I couldn't do it at my home. So I had to leave there, obviously. But when I came back to my home, no one was coming around anymore. My door wasn't getting knocked down, which was all real good. But I still had to go and pay my dealer. I had to go around. I went to my dealer. Hadn't seen or spoken to him in years. I've deleted all my Facebooks ever. No one can contact me. They've probably been chasing me for like quite a while and not know where I am. And I just walked in there with all the money. And when I walked in there, the whole table was just full of meth and pipes and all that there. And I put the money on the table. My dealer said, I know you've been rehabbing, so I'm not even going to offer you any of this, but it's there. And I just went, no, man, I don't need it. And that was then that I knew that I could now sit in front of a big pile of meth and look at it and not even have that inkling to have it. It took me about a year to get to that, but I was proud of myself that I actually paid that bill and just, no, love you guys. See you later. You know, like, all the best. And just walked out of there and never went back. So that was a big, like, big thing to be able to, like, do that. You know, it was massive. And that was when I knew I was starting to think, like, you're getting over this, man. You're conquering this. Not fully conquered yet. I'd been clean for 13 months in my past. And that was the longest I'd ever been clean for a long period of time. So I had been clean for 13 months and relapsed again. And then I remember I got clean for 8 months one time and then relapsed again. So I was at about that year mark, but to be able to do that, man, I was just like, man, you're conquering this, you know? Like, I felt really good about, yeah, you're getting over this. You're going to do it, you know?
Just out of curiosity, have you felt any other, aside from when your brother passed, were there any other moments where you were like, oh shit, I might use again or?
Man, to be truthful, after that incident I just spoke about, and then even when my brother passed, everyone else thought I was going to relapse except for me, right? So all these people came around and really put this big shell around me. And maybe that's why I didn't. But in my mind, I wasn't anyway. I was like, man, you're not going to let this hurt you. I had a lot of strategies that I'd been given from my therapist and stuff that really helped me sort of veer away from that, being disconnected from anyone who could have helped me get on, was key. But here's the other thing that's key. All these people from my past that I've loved and cherished, and I thought they were my people and all that there. When my brother died, do you think that would have been the time that if they did love me, they would have come and knocked on my door and said, "Man, sorry to hear about your brother." You know, I've dealt to thousands and thousands of people in Rockingham and Kwinana over the last 20 years, like thousands and thousands, you know, whatever. And I think that this is a community that love me. When my brother died, not one of them came and knocked on my door and said, "Sorry." So that shows what that love was. And that really helped me realize, yeah, that there was love there, but it was they loved that I had drugs. And that's all it ever was. Because if there was a time when they would have come back into my life, it would have been when my brother died. And the fact that none did, I'm so happy with, because that means that I didn't have to deal with the, "Look, do you want some of this to get over your brother?" You know, like I didn't have to deal with any of that. So I'm kind of happy that none of them did. But it kind of confirmed that thing where I was in that world with people I thought loved me. And if there was ever a time they were going to come and show that love, you think it would be when your brother died. I'm still in the same house I dealt out of. It's smashed all over Facebook. People heard about it, and not one came and knocked on my door. So that's like, but I'm glad that it didn't. I'm glad they didn't.
And I'm thinking of when you got started on the path. So if I'm thinking about being a mother or something, you
Yeah.
know, as someone watching your child go down this route, is there anything that could have changed or would have been different, like that you can imagine? Or do you see this as your destiny? Like, how do you?
It all started probably when dad left home. When I was younger, once dad left home, structure left the house, us kids started getting up to mischief. Mum was off working all day trying to do what she was doing. And mum was really busy at nights with all meetings and stuff. You know, like she laid a lot of groundwork for even for places like Kulbati and that to exist today. And I'm really proud of all that. But a lot of that, like my mum worked a full-time job, and a lot of that was done after hours and stuff. And us kids were kind of left to our own device, and we kind of all just about went off the rails. My other brother and my other sister, they both done hard, hard time, like 10 years plus time. I found myself in jail. My other brother was a raging alcoholic. And my other sister, she was, I guess my other sister was okay. She was a little bit dysfunctional, but she was okay. But our whole family just sort of became really dysfunctional. And I remember jumping out of my window one day when I was really young, about 13, jumped out, just left. Not going to school no more. That's how I left school, left everything. So I kind of trace it back to my dad leaving. I wish my dad would have stayed. When he didn't, I wish, like I'm proud of all my mum's achievements, but I wish, but it cost us our mum as a family. So I wish we would have had our mum around a lot more often. But saying that, we're all got our own agency. I was a young man going out in the world. I went out, I did hold down jobs. I did a butcher's apprenticeship when I was really young, but I always dealt drugs. So even while I was working, I dealt drugs. When I didn't work, I was on Centrelink, I dealt drugs. Like no matter what I do, I was always attached to this drug dealing side of me. And it just grew and grew and grew. In those early days, I remember I used to just steal weed. But once meth came in, that was a totally different story. And I thought that I could handle this drug and deal it just like I had with weed. But no, it's a totally different story. And it was during dealing meth, I lost everything that I had acquired. Even though I acquired it kind of illegally dealing weed, I'd acquired quite a lot. I lost all of that once meth came into the picture. My advice is looking back, I tolerate very little now. You know that one beer that you give to your young child? No, I'm a no person now. You know that, "Oh, it's all right, it's only weed," kind of attitude that we have to marijuana? I'm like, no, it's weed. Like it's not okay. When we just did our Psy 389 unit, they ask all these questions and check the tolerance of everyone. And I had one of the hardest tolerances in the class. And people spin out. They're like, "You know, like you come from that world. Why are you saying no to all this?" And I'm like, "Because I've seen where that ends. And that one cigarette that you allow your daughter to have with her friends, I see the outcome of that and where that leads. That one cone you let your son have with his mates and say, 'Oh, well, it's okay, it's only weed.' I see where that ends now. I see where it ends. I think we've got to be parents. We've got to be parents and get our power back and the ability to actually say, 'No, this is not right.'" Even when I was in the drug world, I was a really, really hard parent. People used to spin out because I'll be up like being so strict with my kids. And then I'll be in the back room like smoking pipes and drinking, and all my mates would be over and partying. We had this kind of had like kind of this double life. And even my mates used to come out, they go, man, you're a strict parent for someone who's doing all the wrong things. And I'll be like, yeah, I am, mate, like disagreeing with it. I'm fortunate that I'm one of the lucky ones that come out and none of my kids are on drugs. None, they're all lovely kids. I've been blessed with that. But I'm so lucky I have that, because if we want to go by modeling behavior, I was the worst model parent you could ever be. I modeled everything that my kids shouldn't do and then told them that they shouldn't do it. You know, you shouldn't have weed. Well, why have you got bucket loads of it in the shed? You shouldn't have this. Well, why have you, you know, that's me. Don't drink alcohol. You and your mates drink here every weekend. If you're looking at modeling behavior, I'm one of the worst parents that could have modeled anything to the children. And let me tell you, when I got clean and my kids actually came and spoke to me, they actually told me, they said, Dad, we knew what you were doing when we were in primary school. And I never thought they did. I thought that I'd kept it from them for so long. And they were like telling me when they were in grade five, they'd be stealing hundreds of my dollars and stuff, like, because I can't control my money. And taking it to school, and they were real popular at school for buying people lunches and all that with all my drug money and that. And they didn't admit this until later in life. But trust me, if you're doing this and you have children at home, they know a lot more about what you're doing. I think is just keep them away from all of it. None of it's good. None of it's good.
Oh, thank you so much. As we come to the end, yeah, what's sitting with anything else that you need to say that you haven't said or I haven't touched on?
Well, I guess I might talk about my testimony night. If anyone is struggling, or if you know of anyone who's struggling with addiction, you can come to my testimony night. It's on the 10th of August at Salvation Army in Coolinga. So on Wilmot Drive. Doors open around 6 p.m. But we'll also live stream it from the Unique Creative Facebook page. So if you can't make it, this testimony will be really good for anyone struggling in addiction. So if you know someone struggling in addiction and you hear this podcast, send them a link to my testimony night, because I won't only be sharing about my journey of how I ended up in the church and how I got out of my addiction stuff. I'm also going to share all the support services that helped me along the way, from the withdrawal units that I went to, from drug court, from Kulbati Centre, also the positive lifestyle programs that I've done. I'm going to share all the services during my testimony with people, so that if you don't know where to go or you're struggling to find help, hopefully you might find help in one of the services that I'm going to share. But other than that, I want to say I've been such a good little talk here. I love this. It's so cool. My first ever real sort of podcast. Definitely been cool.
Thank you so much. I really loved it too, and hearing all the different things, and yeah, for you being so generous with your journey, for us and for those who hopefully this finds wherever it needs to find and the people that need it and whatever different, there's so many little pockets of potential things that people could pick up. So thanks, Ezra. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Gabrielle. It's been a pleasure.